At last she stepped forward and continued toward the cathedral porch. Ned stayed where he was. He did not need to see the ceremony close up. The woman he loved was committing her life to another man. Marjorie was serious about promises. For her, a vow was sacred. When she said, "I do," she meant it. Ned knew he was losing her permanently. After the exchange of vows, everyone proceeded into the cathedral for the wedding mass. Ned intoned the responses and looked at the sculpted pilasters and soaring arches. But today the timeless rhythm of the repeated columns and curves failed to soothe his wounded soul. Bart was going to make Marjorie miserable. Ned knew that. The thought that kept recurring, and that Ned could not completely suppress no matter how hard he tried, was that tonight, Bart, that wooden-headed fool in a yellow doublet, would lie in bed with Marjorie and do with her all the things Ned himself longed for. Then it was over, and they were husband and wife. Ned left the cathedral. Now there was no uncertainty and no hope. Ned was going to spend his life without her. He felt sure he would never love anyone else. He would be a lifelong bachelor. He was glad that at least he had a new career that engaged him so powerfully. His work for Elizabeth quite possessed him. If he could not spend his life with Marjorie, he would dedicate himself to Elizabeth. Her ideal of religious tolerance was outrageously radical, of course. Almost the whole world thought that the notion of letting everyone worship as they wished was disgustingly permissive and completely mad. But Ned thought the majority were mad, and people who believed, as Elizabeth did, were the only sane ones. Life without Marjorie would be sad, but not pointless. He had impressed Elizabeth once, by the way he had dealt with Earl Swithin, and now he needed to do it again, by recruiting Dan Cobley and the Kingsbridge Protestants as soldiers in her army. He stopped in the windy square and looked around for Dan, who had not come into the cathedral for the wedding mass. Presumably, Dan had spent the hour thinking about Ned's proposition. How long did he need? Ned spotted him in the graveyard and went to join him. Filbert Cobley had no grave, of course. Heretics did not benefit from Christian burial. Dan was standing at the tomb of his grandparents, Adam and Deborah Cobley.
"We gathered some ashes, furtively, after the burning," Dan said.
His face was wet with tears.
"We brought them here that evening and dug them into the soil at dusk. We'll see him again on the last day."
Ned did not like Dan, but could not help feeling sad for him.
"Amen," he said.
"But it's a long time until Judgment Day, and in the meantime we have to do God's work here on earth."
"I'll help you," Dan said.
"Good man."
Ned was happy. His mission had been accomplished. Elizabeth would be pleased.
"I should have said yes right away, but I've become cautious."
Understandably, Ned thought. But he did not want to dwell on the past, now that Dan had committed himself. He adopted a briskly practical tone. "You'll need to appoint 10 captains, each in charge of 40 men. They won't all have swords, but tell them to find good daggers or hammers. An iron chain can make a useful weapon."
"Is this the advice you're giving to all the Protestant militias?"
"Exactly.
We need disciplined men. You need to take them to a field somewhere and march them up and down. It sounds stupid, but anything that gets them used to moving in unison is good."
Ned was not speaking from his own knowledge or experience. He was repeating what Cecil had told him.
"We might be seen marching," Dan said dubiously.
"Not if you're discreet." Dan nodded.
"There's something else," he said. "You want to know what Swithin and the Fitzgeralds do?"
"Very much."
"They went to Brussels."
Ned was rocked.
"What? When?"
4 weeks ago."
"I know, because they travelled on a ship of mine. We took them to Antwerp and heard them hiring a guide to take them on to Brussels. They came back on one of my ships, too. They were afraid they might have to postpone the wedding, but they got here 3 days ago."
"King Felipe is in Brussels."
"So I gather."
Ned tried to analyze this as William Cecil would, and in his mind, the dominoes fell one by one. Why did Swithin and the Fitzgeralds want to see King Felipe? To talk about who would rule England when Mary Tudor died.
What had they said to Felipe? That Mary Stuart should be queen, not Elizabeth Tudor. They must have asked Felipe to support Mary, and if Felipe had said yes, Elizabeth was in trouble. Ned became even more worried when he saw Cecil's reaction. I didn't expect King Felipe to support Elizabeth, but I did hope he might stay out of it, Cecil said anxiously. Why wouldn't he support Mary Stuart? He's worried about England coming under the control of her French uncles. He doesn't want France to become too powerful. So much as he wants us to be Catholic again, he's in two minds. I don't want him to be talked into making a decision for Mary Stuart. Ned had not thought of that. It was remarkable how often Cecil pointed out things he had not thought of. He was learning fast, but he felt he would never master the intricacies of international diplomacy. Cecil was moody for an entire day, trying to think of something he could do or say to discourage the Spanish king from interfering. Then he and Ned went to see the Count of Feria. Ned had met Feria once before, back in the summer, when the Spanish courtier had come to Hatfield. Elizabeth had been pleased to see him, taking his visit as a sign that his master, King Felipe, might not be implacably opposed to her. She had turned the full force of her charm on Feria, and he had gone away half in love with her. However, nothing was quite what it seemed in the world of international relations. Ned was not sure how much it meant that Feria was smitten with Elizabeth. He was a smooth diplomat, courteous to all, ruthless beneath the surface. Cecil and Ned found Feria in London. The city of London was small by comparison with Antwerp, Paris, or Seville, but it was the beating heart of England's growing commercial life. From London, a road ran west, along the river, through palaces and mansions, with gardens running down to the beach. 2 miles from London was the separate city of Westminster, which was the centre of government. Whitehall, Westminster Yard, and St. James's Palace were where noblemen, councillors, and courtiers gathered to thrash out the laws that made it possible for the merchants to do business. Feria had an apartment in the sprawl of assorted buildings known as Whitehall Palace. Cecil and Ned were lucky. They caught him as he was about to return to his master in Brussels. Cecil was not fluent in Spanish, but happily Feria spoke good English. Cecil pretended he had been passing Feria's door and had merely dropped in to pay his respects. Feria politely pretended to believe him. They danced around each other for a few minutes, speaking platitudes. A lot was at stake underneath the courtesies. King Felipe believed it was his holy duty to support the Catholic Church. It was perfectly possible for Swithin and Sir Reginald to talk the Spanish king into opposing Elizabeth. Once the formalities were done, Cecil said, "Between us, England and Spain have very nearly defeated France and Scotland." Ned noted the odd emphasis. England had had little to do with the war. It was Spain that was winning, and Scotland was almost irrelevant. But Cecil was reminding Feria who his friends were. Feria said, "The war is almost won. King Felipe must be pleased, and most grateful for the assistance of his English subjects." Cecil nodded acknowledgement and got down to business. "By the way, Count, have you been in touch recently with Mary Stuart, the Queen of the Scots?" Ned was surprised by the question. Cecil had not told him in advance what he planned to say. Feria was surprised too. "Good Lord, no," he said. "Why on earth do you want me to communicate with her?" "Oh, I'm not saying you should, although I would if I were you."
"Why?"
"Well, she may be the next Queen of England, even though she's a mere girl. One could say the same of Princess Elizabeth." Ned frowned. Feria had misjudged Elizabeth if he thought she was a mere girl. Perhaps he was not as sharp as people said. Cecil ignored the remark. "In fact, I understand that King Felipe has been asked to support Scottish Mary's claim to the throne." Cecil paused, giving Feria the chance to deny this. Feria said nothing. Ned concluded that his guesswork had been accurate. Swithin and Reginald had asked Felipe to support Mary Stuart. Cecil went on. In your place, I would ask Mary Stuart for a very specific commitment. I would want her to guarantee that under her rule, England will not change sides to join forces with France and Scotland against Spain. After all, at this stage, that's just about the only development that could prevent Spain winning this war. Ned marvelled. Cecil's imagination had come up with just the right fantasy to scare Ferrier, and his master, the King of Spain. Ferrier said, "Surely you don't think that's likely?" "I think it's inevitable," Cecil said, though Ned felt sure he thought no such thing. "Mary Stuart is technically ruler of Scotland, though her mother acts as regent on her behalf, and Mary's husband is heir to the throne of France. How could she be disloyal to both her countries? She is sure to turn England against Spain, unless you do something now to prevent it." Ferrier nodded thoughtfully. "And I'm guessing you have a suggestion," he said. Cecil shrugged. "I hardly dare offer advice to the most distinguished diplomat in Europe." Cecil, too, could be smooth when necessary. "But if King Felipe really is considering a request from English Catholics to support Mary Stuart as heir to the throne of England, I do think His Majesty might first ask her for a guarantee that, as Queen of England, she will not declare war on Spain. He could make that a condition of his support." "He could," Ferrier said neutrally. Ned was confused. Cecil was supposed to be talking Ferrier out of supporting Mary Stuart. Instead, he seemed to be suggesting how King Felipe might overcome the main problem. Was there yet again something here Ned was not seeing? Cecil stood up. "I'm glad we had the chance to chat," he said. "I only looked in to say bon voyage. It's always a pleasure to see you. Please give my respects to the lovely Elizabeth. I'll tell her. She'll be glad." As soon as they were outside, Ned said, "I don't understand. Why did you make that helpful suggestion about asking Mary Stuart for a guarantee?" Cecil smiled. "First of all, King Henri of France will never allow his daughter-in-law to make such a promise." Ned had not thought of that. She was still only 15. She could not do anything without approval. Cecil went on. "Secondly, her guarantee would be worthless. She would just break it after she took the throne, and there would be nothing anyone could do to hold her to it. And King Felipe will see both of those snags, or, if he doesn't, Count Ferrier will point them out to him." "So why did you suggest it?" "As the fastest way to alert Ferrier and Felipe to the hazards of supporting Mary Stuart. Ferrier won't take up my suggestion, but he's now thinking hard about what else he could do to protect Spain, and soon Felipe will be thinking about it too." "And what will they do?" "I don't know, but I know what they won't do. They won't help Earl Swithin and Sir Reginald. They won't throw their weight behind the campaign for Mary Stuart. And that makes things a lot more hopeful for us." Queen Mary Tudor departed her earthly life gradually and majestically, like a mighty galleon inching out of its berth. As she got weaker, lying in bed in her private apartment in St. James's Palace, London, Elizabeth at Hatfield received more and more visitors. Representatives of noble families and rich businesses came to tell her how unhappy they were about religious persecution. Others sent messages offering to do anything they could for her. Elizabeth spent half the day dictating to secretaries, sending a blizzard of short notes, thanking people for their loyalty, firming up friendships. The implied message in every letter was, "I will be an energetic monarch, and I will remember who helped me at the start." Ned and Tom Parry were in charge of military preparations. They commandeered a nearby house, Brocket Hall, and made it their headquarters. From there, they liaised with Elizabeth's backers in the provincial towns, preparing to deal with a Catholic uprising. Ned added up the number of soldiers they could muster, calculated how long it would take each group to get to Hatfield, and wrestled with the problem of finding weapons for them all. Cecil's sly intervention with Count Ferrier had been effective. Ferrier was back in England in the second week of November. He met with the Privy Council, the monarch's most powerful group of advisers, and told them that King Felipe supported Elizabeth as heir to the throne. Queen Mary, insofar as she was able to do anything at all, seemed to have accepted her husband's decision. Then Ferrier came to Hatfield. He walked in, all smiles, a man with good news for a captivating woman. The Spanish were the richest people in the world, and Ferrier wore a red doublet, delicately pinked, to show the gold lining. His black cloak had a red lining and gold embroidery. Ned had never seen anyone looking quite so pleased with himself.
"Madame, I bring you a gift," he said.
In the room with Elizabeth and Ferrier were Cecil, Tom Parry, and Ned. Elizabeth liked presents but hated surprises, and she said guardedly,
"How kind. A gift from my master and yours, King Felipe,"
Ferrier went on. Felipe was still Elizabeth's master, technically, for Mary Tudor was still alive, still Queen of England, and therefore her husband was King of England. But Elizabeth was not pleased to be reminded of this. Ned saw the signs. Her chin raised a fraction, the ghost of a frown on her pale brow, a barely perceptible stiffening of her body in the carved oak chair. But Ferrier missed them. He went on.
"King Felipe gives you the throne of England."
He took a step back and bowed, as if expecting a round of applause or a kiss. Elizabeth looked calm, but Ned could tell she was thinking hard. Ferrier brought good news, but delivered it with magnificent condescension. What would Elizabeth say? After a moment, Ferrier added,
"May I be the first to congratulate you, Your Majesty?"
Elizabeth nodded regally, but still said nothing. Ned knew such a silence to be ominous.
"I have informed the Privy Council of King Felipe's decision," Ferrier added.
"My sister is dying, and I am to be queen," Elizabeth said. "I feel a kind of defeated joy, gladness and sorrow equal in the balance."
Ned thought she had probably prepared those words. Ferrier said,
"Queen Mary, despite her illness, was able to ratify her husband's choice."
Something had changed subtly in his manner, and Ned instinctively suspected that Ferrier was now lying. Ferrier went on,
"She designates you her heir, on condition that you promise to keep England Catholic."
Ned's spirits fell again. Elizabeth's hands would be tied from the start of her reign if she agreed to this. Bishop Julius and Sir Reginald would continue to do anything they pleased in Kingsbridge. Ned glanced at Cecil. He did not seem dismayed. Perhaps he, too, thought Ferrier was lying. Cecil's expression showed faint amusement, and he was looking expectantly at Elizabeth. There was a long silence. Ferrier broke it by saying,
"May I tell the King and Queen that you consent to their decision?"
When Elizabeth spoke at last, her voice was like the crack of a whip.
"No, sir, you may not."
Ferrier looked as if he had been slapped.
But
Elizabeth did not give him the chance to protest.
"If I become Queen, it will be because I have been chosen by God, not King Felipe," she said.
Ned wanted to cheer. She went on,
"If I rule, it will be by the consent of the English people, not of my dying sister."
Ferrier was thunderstruck. Elizabeth's scorn became vitriolic.
"And when I am crowned, I will take the oath customary to an English sovereign, and will not add extra promises proposed to me by the Count of Ferrier."
For once, Ferrier did not know what to say. He had played his cards in the wrong order, Ned realized. Ferrier should have demanded a promise of Catholicism from Elizabeth before endorsing her to the Privy Council. Now it was too late. Ned guessed that at their first meeting, Ferrier had been misled. By Elizabeth's alluring manner, into thinking she was a weak female who could be manipulated by a strong-minded man. But she had played him, instead of the other way around. Ferio was not a fool, and he saw all this in a flash, Ned could tell. Suddenly, Ferio looked deflated, an empty wineskin. He made as if to speak, then changed his mind several times. Ned guessed he could think of nothing to say that would make any difference. Elizabeth put him out of his misery.
"Thank you for coming to visit us, Count," she said. "Please give our best greetings to King Felipe, and though hope is slender, we will pray for Queen Mary."
Ned wondered whether she meant to include her staff in the good wishes, or was already using the royal "we." Knowing her, he decided the ambiguity was probably intentional. Ferrier took his dismissal as graciously as he could and backed out of the room. Ned grinned happily. He thought of Earl Swithin and said quietly to Cecil, "Well, Count Ferrier isn't the first man to suffer for underestimating Elizabeth."
"No," said Cecil, "and I don't suppose he'll be the last."
When Marjorie was 9 years old, she had announced that she was going to be a nun. She was awestruck by the devout life led by her great-aunt, Sister Joan, living on the top floor of the house with her altar and her prayer beads. Joan had dignity and independence and a purpose in life. All the nunneries had been abolished, along with the monasteries, by Henry VIII, and Queen Mary Tudor had failed to restore them. But that was not the reason Marjorie abandoned her ambition. The truth was that as soon as she reached puberty, she knew that she could never live a life of celibacy. She loved boys, even when they acted stupid. She liked their boldness and their strength and their humor, and she was excited by the yearning stares they directed at her body. She even liked how blind they were to subtleties and hidden meanings. There was something attractive about their straightforwardness, and sometimes girls were so sly. So she had given up on the plan of becoming a nun, but she was still drawn to the idea of a life devoted to a mission. She confessed this to Sister Joan on the day she was to move to Newcastle, while her clothes, books, and jewellery were being loaded onto a four-wheeled cart for the journey.
"Don't worry about it," Sister Joan said, sitting on a wooden stool, straight-backed and alert, despite her age. "God has a purpose for you. He has a purpose for all of us. But how can I find out what his purpose is for me?" "Why, you can't find out," said Sister Joan. "You must just wait for him to reveal it. God won't be hurried."
Marjorie vowed to use self-control, although she was beginning to feel that her life was an exercise in self-control. She had submitted to her parents in marrying part. With her new husband, she had spent the last 2 weeks at a house on Leper Island, owned by the Earl, and during that time Bart had made it clear that he expected Marjorie to submit to him in the same way she had submitted to her parents. He decided on his own where they would go and what they would do, and then simply issued instructions to her as he might have done to a steward. She had expected their marriage to be more of a partnership, but that thought seemed never to have crossed Bart's mind. She hoped she might change him, gradually and subtly, but he was awfully like his father. Her proud family came with her on the journey to Newcastle, Sir Reginald, Lady Jane, and Rollo. They were related to the Earl now, and revelling in their connection with the aristocracy. Also, the men were eager to confer with Earl Swithin. Their trip to Brussels had failed. King Felipe had seemed to listen to them and agree with their point of view. But someone else must have got to him, for in the end he had thrown the weight of his support behind Elizabeth. Rollo was bitterly disappointed, Marjorie could see. On the journey, Reginald and Rollo discussed what to do next. The only recourse left to them was an armed uprising against Elizabeth immediately after the death of Mary Tudor. They needed to know how many men-at-arms Earl Swithin could muster, and who among the Catholic nobility could be relied upon to support Swithin. Marjorie was troubled. She saw Protestantism as an arrogant heresy, favoured by men who imagined they were clever enough to find fault with hundreds of years of church teaching, but she also believed that Christians should not kill one another. However, as Newcastle loomed up ahead, her mind was on more mundane worries. Earl Swithin was a widower, so Marjorie, now titled Viscountess Shiring, was going to be the lady of the house. She was only 16, and hardly knew what it took to manage a castle. She had talked it over at length with Lady Jane, and made some plans, but she was anxious about facing the reality. Bart had gone ahead, and when the Fitzgerald party arrived, about 20 servants were waiting for them in the courtyard. They clapped and cheered when Marjorie rode in, and she felt welcomed. Perhaps they disliked working for an all-male family and looked forward to a woman's touch. She hoped so. Swithin and Bart came out to greet them. Bart kissed her, then Swithin did the same, letting his lips linger on her cheek and pressing her body to his. Then Swithin introduced a voluptuous woman of about 30.
"Sal Brendan is my housekeeper, and she will help you with everything," he said. "Show the Viscountess around, Sal. We men have a lot to talk about."
As he turned away to usher Reginald and Rollo into the house, he gave Sal a pat on her ample bottom. Sal did not seem surprised or displeased. Both Marjorie and Lady Jane noticed this and looked at one another. Sal was obviously more than a housekeeper.
"I'll take you to your quarters," Sal said. "This way."
Marjorie wanted more of a tour. She had been here before, most recently on the 12th day of Christmas, but it was a big place, and she needed to re-familiarize herself with the layout. She said, "We'll look at the kitchen first." Sal hesitated, looking annoyed, then said,
"As you wish."
They entered the house and went to the kitchen. It was hot and steamy and not too clean. An older servant was sitting on a stool, watching the cook work and drinking from a tankard. When Marjorie entered, he got to his feet rather slowly. Sal said,
"This is the cook, Maeve Brown."
There was a cat sitting on the table picking delicately at the remains of a knuckle of ham. Marjorie lifted the cat up with a swift movement and dropped it on the floor. Maeve Brown said resentfully,
"She's a good mouser, that cat."
Marjorie said, "She'll be a better mouser if you don't let her eat ham." The older manservant began to prepare a tray with a plate of cold beef, a jug of wine, and some bread. Marjorie took a slice of the beef and ate it. The man said,
"That's for the Earl."
"And very good it is, too," Marjorie said. "What's your name?"
"Collie Knight," he said. "Worked for us within 40 years, man and boy."
He said it with an air of superiority, as if to let Marjorie know that she was a mere latecomer.
"I am the Viscountess," Marjorie said. "You should say, my lady, when you speak to me."
There was a long pause. Then, at last, Collie said,
"Yes, my lady."
"Now we will go to the Viscount's quarters," Marjorie said.
Sal Brendan led the way. They passed through the great hall, where a girl of 10 or 11 was sweeping the floor in a desultory way, holding the brush with one hand.
"Get both your hands on that broom handle,"
Marjorie snapped at her as they passed. The girl looked startled, but did as she was told. They went up the stairs and along the corridor to the end. The bedchamber was a corner room with communicating doors to two side rooms. Marjorie immediately liked that arrangement. It meant that Bart could have a dressing room for his muddy boots, and Marjorie could have a boudoir where maids could help with her clothes and hair. But all the rooms were filthy. The windows seemed not to have been washed for a year. There were two big dogs lying on a blanket, an old one and a young one. Marjorie saw dog shit on the floor, but obviously let his pets do as they pleased in his rooms. On the wall was a painting of a naked woman, but the room contained no flowers or greenery, no plates of fruit or raisins, no fragrant bowls of dried herbs and petals to scent the air. On a chair was a tangle of laundry, including a blood-stained shirt that seemed to have been there a long time.
"This is disgusting,"
Marjorie said to Sal Brendan.
"We're going to clean the place up before I open my trunks. Go and fetch brooms and a shovel. The first thing you'll do is clean up the dog shit."
Sal put her hand on her hip and looked mutinous.
"Earl Swithin is my master," she said. "You'd better speak to him."
Something in Marjorie snapped. She had been deferring to people too long. Her parents, Bishop Julius, Bart. She was not going to defer to Sal Brendan. All the bottled fury of the past year boiled over inside her. She drew back her arm and gave Sal a terrific slap across the face. The crack of palm on cheek was so loud that one of the dogs jumped. Sal fell back with a cry of shock.
"Don't ever speak to me like that again," Marjorie said. "I know your type. Just because the Earl gives you a fuck when he's drunk, you think you're the Countess."
Marjorie saw a flare of recognition in Sal's eyes that confirmed the truth of the accusation.
"I am mistress of this house now, and you'll obey me. And if you give trouble, you'll be out of here so fast. Your feet won't touch the ground until you land in the Kingsbridge whorehouse, which is probably where you belong."
Sal was visibly tempted to defy her. Her face was suffused with rage, and she might even have hit back. But she hesitated. She had to realize that if the Earl's new daughter-in-law were to ask him to get rid of an insolent servant, today of all days, he could not possibly refuse. Sal saw sense, and her face changed.
I ask your pardon, m'lady, she said humbly. I'll fetch the brooms right away.
She left the room. Lady Jane said quietly to Marjorie,
"Well done."
Marjorie spotted a riding whip on a stool beside a pair of spurs and picked it up. She crossed the room to where the dogs lay.
"Get out, you filthy beasts," she said, and gave each of them a smart smack.
More shocked than hurt, both dogs jumped up and scampered from the room, looking indignant.
"And stay out," said Marjorie.
Rollo refused to believe that the tide was turning against Mary Stuart. How could it, he asked himself indignantly, when England was a Catholic country and Mary had the support of the Pope? So that afternoon he wrote a letter for Earl Swithin to send to the Archbishop of Canterbury, Cardinal Pole. The letter asked for the Archbishop's blessing on an armed insurrection against Elizabeth Tudor. Violence was now the only hope. King Felipe had turned against Mary Stuart and backed Elizabeth. That meant disaster for Rollo, the Fitzgerald family, and the true Catholic Christian faith in England.
"Is this treason?"
Swithin asked as he picked up the pen.
"No,"
said Rollo. "Elizabeth is not queen yet, so no one is conspiring to rebel against the sovereign." Rollo knew that if they lost, and Elizabeth won the crown, she would consider that a distinction without a difference. So they were all risking execution, but at moments such as this, men had to take sides. Swithin signed it, not without difficulty, for he found it easier to break in a wild horse than to write his name. Paul was ill, but he could surely dictate a letter, Rollo thought. What would he say in reply to Swithin? Paul was the most hard-line Catholic of all the English bishops, and Rollo felt almost certain he would support a revolt. Then the actions of Swithin and his supporters would be legitimized by the church. Two of Swithin's trusted men were given the letter to carry to Lambeth Palace, the Archbishop's residence near London. Meanwhile, Sir Reginald and Lady Jane returned to Kingsbridge. Rollo stayed with the Earl. He wanted to make sure there was no backsliding. While waiting for the Archbishop's reply, Swithin and Bart set about mustering a force of armed men. Other Catholic earls must have been doing the same thing all over England, Rollo reckoned, and their combined forces would be irresistible. In 100 villages in the county of Shiring, Earl Swithin was lord and master, with much of the same absolute authority that his ancestors had wielded in the Middle Ages. Swithin and Bart visited some of these places personally. The earl's servants read a proclamation in others, and parish priests gave the same message in their sermons. Single men, between 18 and 30, were summoned to Newcastle and ordered to bring with them axes, scythes, and iron chains. Rollo had no experience of anything like this and could not guess what would happen. The response thrilled him. Every village sent half a dozen lads. They were keen to go. The makeshift weapons and the young men carrying them were not much needed in the fields in November. And Protestantism was an urban movement. It had never taken hold in the conservative countryside. Besides, this was the most exciting thing that had happened in living memory. Everyone was talking about it. Beardless boys and old men wept that they were not wanted. The army could not remain many days at Newcastle, and anyway, it was a long march to Hatfield, so they set off, even though they had not heard back from Cardinal Pole. Their route would take them through Kingsbridge, where they would receive the blessing of Bishop Julius. Swithin rode at the head of the column, with Bart at his side and Rollo behind. They reached Kingsbridge on the third day. Entering the city, they were stopped at Merthyn's Bridge by Rollo's father, Sir Reginald, who was the mayor. He was accompanied by the aldermen of the borough. "I'm sorry," Reginald said to Swithin. "There's a difficulty." Rollo eased his horse forward so that he was at the front with Swithin and Bart. "What on earth is the matter?" he said. His father seemed in despair. "If you will dismount and come with me, I'll show you," he said. Swithin said irascibly, "This is a poor way to welcome a holy crusade." "I know," said Reginald. "Believe me, I am mortified. But come and look." The three leaders got off their horses. Swithin summoned the captains, gave them money, and told them to get barrels of beer sent over from the Slaughterhouse Tavern to keep the men happy. Reginald led them across the double bridge into the city and up the main street to the market square. There, they saw an astonishing sight. The market stalls were closed, the temporary structures having been removed, and the square had been cleared. 40 or 50 stout tree trunks, all 6 or 8 inches in diameter, had been firmly planted in the hard winter earth. Several hundred young men stood around the stakes, and Rollo saw, with increasing astonishment, that all of them had wooden swords and shields. It was an army in training. As they watched, a leader performed a demonstration on a raised stage, attacking the stake with a wooden sword and shield, using right and left arms alternately in a rhythm that, Rollo could imagine, would have been effective on the battlefield. When the demonstration was over, all the others tried to imitate his actions, taking it in turns. Rollo recalled seeing similar exercises in Oxford, when Queen Mary Tudor had been preparing to send an English army to France to support the Spanish War. The stakes were called pels. They were firmly seated and difficult to knock over. At first, he remembered, untrained men's swings were so wild that they sometimes missed the pel entirely. They quickly learned to aim carefully and hit harder. He had heard military men say that a few afternoons of pel practice could turn a hopeless yokel into a halfway dangerous soldier. Rollo saw Dan Cobley among the trainees, and the last piece of the puzzle fell into place. This was a Protestant army. They would not call themselves that, of course. They would claim to be preparing to resist a Spanish invasion, perhaps. Sir Reginald and Bishop Julius would not believe them. But what could they do? The dozen or so men of the city watch could not arrest and jail several hundred, even if the trainees were breaking the law, which they probably were not. Rollo watched in despair as the young men attacked the pels, rapidly becoming more focused and effective. "This is not a coincidence," he said. "They heard of the approach of our army and mustered their own to obstruct us." Reginald said, "Earl Swithin, if your army enters the town, there will be a pitched battle in the streets." "My strong-armed village lads will smash these puny city Protestants. The aldermen will not admit your men." "Overrule the cards," Swithin said. "I don't have the right, and they have said they will arrest me if I try." "Let them. We'll get you out of jail," Bart said. "We'll have to fight our way across that damn bridge." "We can do that," Swithin blustered. "We'd lose a lot of men." "That's what they're for. But then who would we take to Hatfield?"
Rollo watched Swithin's face. It was not in his character to yield, even when the odds were against him. His expression showed furious indecision. Bart said, "I wonder if the same thing is happening elsewhere. Protestants getting ready to fight, I mean." This had not occurred to Rollo. When he had proposed that Swithin raise a small army, he should have guessed that the Protestants would be thinking the same way. He had foreseen a neat coup d'etat, but instead he was facing a bloody civil war. And instinct told him the English people did not want a civil war, and might well turn on men who started one. It was beginning to look as if the peasant lads would have to be sent home. Two men emerged from the nearby Bell Inn and came hurrying over. Seeing them, Reginald remembered something. "There's a message for you, Earl," he said. "These two men got here an hour ago.
I told them to wait, rather than risk missing you on the road. Rollo recognized the men Swithin had sent to Lambeth Palace. What had Archbishop Pole said? That could prove crucial. With his encouragement, perhaps Swithin's army could continue to Hatfield. Without it, they might be wiser to disband. The older of the two couriers spoke.
"There's no reply from the Cardinal," he said.
Rollo's heart sank.
"What do you mean, no reply?"
Swithin said angrily.
"He must have said something."
"We spoke to his clerk, Canon Robinson. He told us the Cardinal was too ill to read your letter, let alone reply to it."
"Why, he must be at death's door," said Swithin.
"Yes, my lord."
This was catastrophic, Rollo thought. England's leading ultra-Catholic was dying at this turning point in the country's history. The fact changed everything. The idea of kidnapping Elizabeth and sending for Mary Stuart had seemed, until now, like a hopeful enterprise with a great chance of success. Now it looked suicidal. Sometimes, Rollo reflected, fate seemed to be on the side of the devil. Ned moved to London and haunted St. James's Palace, waiting for news of Queen Mary Tudor. She weakened dramatically on November 16th, a day that Protestants began to call Hope Wednesday, even before the sun went down. Ned was in the shivering crowd outside the tall red brick gatehouse the following morning, just before dawn, when a servant, hurrying out with a message, whispered,
"She's gone."
Ned ran across the road to the Coach and Horses Tavern. He ordered a horse to be saddled, then woke his messenger, Peter Hopkins. While Hopkins was getting dressed and drinking a flagon of ale for breakfast, Ned wrote a note telling Elizabeth that Mary Tudor was dead. Then he saw the man off to Hatfield. He returned to the gatehouse and found the crowd grown larger. For the next 2 hours, he watched important courtiers and less important messengers hurry in and out. But when he saw Nicholas Heath emerge, he followed him. Heath was probably the most powerful man in England. He was Archbishop of York, Queen Mary's Chancellor, and the holder of the Great Seal. Cecil had tried to win him to the cause of Elizabeth, but Heath had remained uncommitted. Now he would have to jump, one way or the other. Heath and his entourage rode the short distance to Westminster, where members of Parliament would be gathering for the morning session. Ned and others ran behind them. Another crowd was already forming at Westminster. Heath announced that he would address the Lords and Commons together, and they assembled in the House of Lords. Ned tried to slip in with Heath's entourage, but a guard stopped him. Ned pretended to be surprised and said, "I represent the Princess Elizabeth. She has ordered me to attend and report to her." The guard was disposed to make trouble, but Heath heard the altercation and intervened.
"I've met you, young man," he said to Ned, "with Sir William Cecil, I think."
"Yes, my lord Archbishop."
It was true, though Ned was surprised that Heath remembered.
"Let him in,"
Heath said to the guard. The fact that Parliament was sitting meant that the succession could happen quickly, especially if Heath backed Elizabeth. She was popular, she was the sister of Queen Mary Tudor, and she was only 20 miles away. Mary Stuart, by contrast, was unknown to the English. She had a French husband, and she was in Paris. Expediency favoured Elizabeth, but the Church favoured Mary Stuart. The debating chamber resounded with animated conversation as everyone in the room discussed the same question. Then they fell silent when Heath stood up.
"God, this present morning, called to his mercy our late Sovereign Lady Queen Mary," he said.
The assembly gave a collective sigh. All of them either knew this or had heard rumours, but the confirmation was heavy.
"But we have cause to rejoice, with praise to Almighty God, for that he left us a true, lawful, and right inheritress to the crown."
The chamber went dead silent. Heath was about to name the next queen. But which one would it be?
"Lady Elizabeth," he said, "whose most lawful right and title we need not doubt."
The room exploded in uproar. Heath carried on speaking, but no one heard. The Archbishop had endorsed Elizabeth, calling her title lawful, in direct contradiction of the Pope's ruling. It was all over.
A few of the members of Parliament were shouting in protest, but Ned could see that most of them were cheering. Elizabeth was Parliament's choice. Perhaps they had been afraid to reveal their feelings while the issue was in doubt, but now their inhibitions fell away. Cecil might even have underestimated Elizabeth's popularity, Ned saw. Although there were some long faces in the chamber, men neither applauding nor cheering, but sitting silent with folded arms, they were a minority. The rest were delighted. Civil war had been avoided. There would be no foreign king. The burnings would end. Ned realized that he was cheering too. Heath left the chamber, followed by most of the Privy Council, and stood on the steps outside to repeat his proclamation to the waiting crowd. He then announced that he would read it again in the City of London. But before he left, he beckoned to Ned. "I expect you'll ride to Hatfield now with the news," he said. "Yes, my Lord Archbishop. You may tell Queen Elizabeth that I will be with her before nightfall."
"Thank you."
"Don't stop to celebrate until after you have delivered the message."
"Certainly not, sir."
Heath left. Ned ran back to the coach and horses. A few minutes later, he was on the road to Hatfield. He had a good, steady mare, which he trotted and walked alternately. He was afraid to push her too hard for fear she would break down. Speed was not crucial, as long as he got there before Heath. He had set off at mid-morning, and it was mid-afternoon when he saw the red brick gables of Hatfield Palace ahead. Hopkins was there already, presumably, so everyone already knew that Queen Mary Tudor was dead. But no one knew who was the new monarch. As he rode into the courtyard, several grooms shouted at once, "What's the news?" Ned decided that Elizabeth herself must be the first to know. He said nothing to the grooms and kept his face expressionless. Elizabeth was in her parlour with Cecil, Tom Parry, and Nell Bainsford. They all stared at him in tense silence as he walked in, still wearing his heavy riding cloak. He walked up to Elizabeth. He tried to remain solemn, but he could not help smiling. She read his expression, and he saw her lips move slightly in a responding smile.
"You are the Queen of England," he said.
He took off his hat, bent his knee, and made a deep, sweeping bow.
"Your Majesty," he said.
We were happy, because we had no idea how much trouble we were causing. It was not just me, of course. I was the junior partner with others who were older and a good deal wiser, but none of us saw the future. We had been warned. Rollo Fitzgerald had lectured me on how much opposition Queen Elizabeth would face and what a pitiful few European leaders would support her. I paid him no heed, but he was right, the sanctimonious bastard. What we did in that momentous year of 1558 caused political strife, revolt, civil war, and invasion. There were times in later years when, in the depths of despair, I would wonder whether it had been worth it. The simple idea that people should be allowed to worship as they wished caused more suffering than the 10 plagues of Egypt. So, if I had known then what I know now, would I have done the same? Hell yes.
Part 2. 1559 to 1563. Chapter 9. Strolling along the southern side of the Ile de la Cité on a sunny Friday in June, with the winged cathedral on one side and the sparkling river on the other, Sylvie Palot said to Pierre Aumond, "Do you want to marry me or not?" She had the satisfaction of seeing a flash of panic in his eyes. This was unusual. His equanimity was not easily disturbed. He was always controlled. He regained his composure so quickly that she might almost have imagined the lapse.
"Of course I want to marry you, my darling," he said, and he looked hurt. "How could you ask such a question?"
She regretted it instantly. She adored him, and hated to see him upset in any way. He looked especially lovable now, with the breeze off the river ruffling his blonde mane, but she hardened her heart and persisted with her question.
"We've been betrothed for more than a year. It's too long."
Everything else in Sylvie's life was good. Her father's bookshop was booming, and he was planning to open a second store on the other side of the river, in the university quarter. His illegal trade in French language Bibles and other banned books was going even better. Hardly a day went by when Sylvie did not go to the secret warehouse in the Rue de Mur for a book or two to sell to a Protestant family. New Protestant congregations were coming up like bluebells in spring, in Paris and elsewhere. As well as spreading the true gospel, the Palots were making healthy profits. But Pierre's behavior puzzled and troubled her.
"I need to finish my studies, and Father Moineau refused to allow me to continue as a married student," he said now. "I explained that to you, and you agreed to wait. For a year, and in a few days' time, lectures will be over for the summer. We have my parents' consent. We have enough money. We can live over the shop, at least until we have children. But you haven't said anything."
"I've written to my mother."
"You didn't tell me."
"I'm waiting for her answer."
"What was the question?"
"Whether she's well enough to travel to Paris for the wedding."
"And if she's not?"
"Let's not worry about that unless it happens."
Sylvie was not happy with this response, but she let it drop for the moment and said,
"Where shall we have the official ceremony?"
Pierre glanced up at the towers of Notre Dame, and she laughed and said,
"Not there. That's for the nobility."
"At the parish church, I assume."
"And then we'll have our real wedding at our own church."
She meant the old hunting lodge in the forest. Protestants still could not worship openly in Paris, though they did in some French cities.
"I suppose we'll have to invite the Marchioness," Pierre said with a grimace of dislike.
"As the building belongs to her husband?"
It was unfortunate that Pierre had got off on the wrong foot with Marchioness Louise and afterward had not been able to win her round. In fact, the more he tried to charm her, the frostier she became. Sylvie had expected him to brush this aside with a laugh, but it seemed he could not. It made him furious, and Sylvie realized that her outwardly self-assured fiancé was in fact deeply sensitive to any kind of social slight. His vulnerability made her love him more, but it also troubled her, though she was not sure why.
"I suppose it can't be helped,"
Pierre said, his tone light, but his look dark.
"Will you have new clothes?"
She knew how much he liked buying clothes. He smiled. "I should have a somber coat of Protestant grey, shouldn't I?"
"Yes."
He was a faithful worshipper, attending every week. He had quickly got to know everyone in the congregation and had been keen to meet people from other groups in Paris. He had even attended services with other congregations. He had badly wanted to go to the National Synod in Paris in May, the first time French Protestants had dared to hold such a conference. But the arrangements were highly secret, and only long-standing Protestants were invited. Despite this rebuff, he was a thoroughly accepted member of the community, which delighted Sylvie.
"There's probably a tailor specializing in dark clothing for Protestants," he said.
"There is, Dubeuf, in the Rue Saint-Martin. My father goes there, though only when Mother forces him. He could afford a new coat every year, but he won't spend money on what he calls frippery. I expect he'll buy me a wedding dress, but he won't be happy about it. If he won't, I will."
She grabbed his arm, stopped him walking, and kissed him.
"You're wonderful,"
she said, "and you're the most beautiful girl in Paris, in France."
She laughed. It wasn't true, although she did look fetching in the black dress with a white collar. Protestant colors happened to suit her dark hair and fresh complexion. Then she recalled her purpose and became solemn again.
"When you hear back from your mother?"
"Yes."
"We must set a date, whatever she says. I don't want to wait any longer."
"All right."
For a moment she was not sure whether to believe he had assented, and she hesitated to rejoice.
"Do you mean it?"
"Of course.
We'll set a date, I promise."
She laughed with delight.
"I love you,"
she said, and she kissed him again.
"I don't know how much longer I can keep this up," Pierre fretted as he left Sylvie at the door to her father's shop and walked north, across the Notre Dame bridge to the right bank.
Away from the river there was no breeze, and soon he was perspiring. He had already made her wait longer than was reasonable. Her father was even more grumpy than usual, and her mother, who had always favoured Pierre, was inclined to speak curtly to him. Sylvie herself was besotted with him, but even she was discontented. They suspected he was dallying with her, and, of course, they were right. But she was bringing him such a rich harvest. His black leather-bound notebook now contained hundreds of names of Paris Protestants and the addresses where they held their heretical services. Even today she had given him a bonus, a Protestant tailor. He had made the suggestion half in jest, but his speculation had been right, and foolish Sylvie had confirmed it. This could be a priceless lead. The files of Cardinal Charles were already bulging. Surprisingly, Charles had not yet arrested any of the Protestants. Pierre planned to ask him before long when he intended to pounce. He was on his way to meet Cardinal Charles now, but he had time to spare. He went along the Rue Saint-Martin until he found the establishment of René Dubœuf. From outside, it looked much like a regular Paris house, though the windows were larger than usual, and there was a signboard over the door. He went in. He was struck by the air of neatness and order. The room was crammed, but everything was tidy. Rolls of silk and woolen cloth on shelves, precisely aligned. Bowls of buttons arranged by colour. Drawer stacks, all with little signs indicating their contents. A bald man was stooping over a table, carefully cutting a length of cloth with a huge pair of spring scissors that looked very sharp. At the back, a pretty woman sat under an iron chandelier, sewing in the light of a dozen candles. Pierre wondered if she bore a label that read, "Wife." One more Protestant couple did not amount to much, but Pierre hoped to meet some of the customers. The man put down his scissors and came forward to greet Pierre, introducing himself as Dubœuf. He looked hard at Pierre's slashed doublet, apparently appraising it with an expert eye, and Pierre wondered if he thought it too ostentatious for a Protestant. Pierre gave his name. "I need a new coat," he said. "Not too gaudy. Dark grey, perhaps?" "Very good, sir," said the tailor warily. "Did someone recommend me to you, perhaps?" "Gilles Palot, the printer." Dubœuf relaxed. "I know him well. He is to be my father-in-law."
"Congratulations."
Pierre was accepted. That was the first step. Dubœuf was a small man, but he lifted the heavy rolls of cloth down from the shelves with practiced ease. Pierre picked out a grey that was almost black. No other customers came in, disappointingly. Pierre wondered just how he could make use of this Protestant tailor. He could not stay in the shop all day waiting to meet clients. He could set a watch on the place. Gaston Lepin, the captain of the Guise household guard, could find a discreet man, but the watcher would not know the names of the men who came and went, so the exercise would be pointless. Pierre racked his brains. There had to be a way of exploiting this discovery. The tailor picked up a long strip of fine leather and began to measure Pierre's body, sticking coloured pins into the strip to record the width of his shoulders, the length of his arms, and the circumference of his chest and waist.
"You have a fine physique, Monsieur Ormond," he said. "The coat will look very distinguished on you."
Pierre ignored this piece of shopkeeper's flattery. How was he going to get the names of Dubœuf's customers? When all the measurements had been made, Dubœuf took a notebook from a drawer.
"If I might take down your address, Monsieur Ormond."
Pierre stared at the book. Of course, Dubœuf had to know where his customers lived, otherwise it would be too easy for someone to order a coat, then change his mind and simply not return. And even if Dubœuf had a phenomenal memory and could remember every customer and every order, the lack of a written record would surely lead to disputes about bills. No, the obsessively neat Dubœuf would have to keep notes. Pierre had to get a look inside that book. Those names and addresses belonged in his own ledger, the one with the black leather cover that listed all the Protestants he had discovered.
"The address, monsieur?"
Dubœuf repeated.
"I'm at the Collège des Âmes."
Dubœuf found his inkwell dry. With a faintly embarrassed laugh, he said,
"Excuse me one moment while I get a bottle of ink."
He disappeared through a doorway. Pierre saw his chance to look inside the book, but it would be better to get rid of the wife. He went to the back of the room and spoke to her. She was about 18, he guessed, younger than her husband, who was in his 30s.
I wonder, might I ask you for a small cup of wine? It's a dusty day.
Of course, monsieur.
She put down her sewing and went out. Pierre opened the tailor's notebook. As he had hoped, it listed the names and addresses of customers, together with details of garments ordered and fabrics specified, and sums of money owed and paid. He recognized some of the names as those of Protestants he had already identified. He began to feel excited. This book probably listed half the heretics in Paris. It would be a priceless asset to Cardinal Charles. He wished he could slip it inside his doublet, but that would be rash. Instead, he began to memorize as many names as he could. He was still doing so when he heard the voice of Dubuff behind him.
What are you doing?
The tailor looked pale and scared. So he should, Pierre thought. He had made a dangerous error in leaving the book on the table. Pierre closed the book and smiled.
Idle curiosity. Forgive me.
Dubuff said severely,
The notebook is private.
He was unnerved, Pierre saw. Pierre said lightly,
It turns out that I know most of your customers. I'm glad to see that my friends pay their bills.
Dubuff did not laugh. But what could he do? After a moment, Dubuff opened the new ink bottle, dipped his pen, and wrote down Pierre's name and address. The wife came in.
Your wine, sir?
She said, handing Pierre a cup. Dubuff said,
Thank you, Françoise.
She had a nice figure, Pierre noted. He wondered what had attracted her to the older Dubuff. The prospect of a comfortable life with a prosperous husband, perhaps. Or it might even have been love. Dubuff said,
If you would be so kind as to come back a week from today, your new coat will be ready for you to try on. It will be 25 livres.
Splendid.
Pierre did not think he would learn much more from Dubuff today. He drank the wine and took his leave. The wine had not quenched his thirst, so he went into the nearest tavern and got a tankard of beer. He also bought a sheet of paper and borrowed a quill and ink. While drinking the beer, he wrote neatly,
René Dubuff, tailor, Rue Saint-Martin, Françoise Dubuff, wife.
Then he added all the names and addresses he could remember from the notebook. He dried the ink and put the sheet inside his doublet. He would transfer the information to his black book later. Sipping his beer, he wondered impatiently when Cardinal Charles was going to make use of all this information. For the present, the cardinal seemed content to accumulate names and addresses, but the time would come when he would swoop. That would be a day of carnage. Pierre would share in Charles's triumph. However, he shifted uneasily on his tavern stool as he thought of the hundreds of men and women who would be imprisoned, tortured, and perhaps even burned alive. Many of the Protestants were self-righteous prigs, and he would be glad to see them suffer, especially Marchioness Louise. But others had been kind to him, made him welcome at the Hunting Lodge Church, invited him into their homes, and answered his sly questions with a frank honesty that made him wince when he thought how he was deceiving them. Only 18 months ago, the worst thing he had ever done was sponge off a randy widow. It seemed longer. He emptied his tankard and left. It was a short distance to the Rue Saint-Antoine, where a tournament was being held. Paris was partying, again. The treaty with Spain had been signed, and King Henri II was celebrating the peace, and pretending he had not lost the war. The Rue Saint-Antoine was the widest street in Paris, which was why it was used for tournaments. Along one side was the massive, ramshackle Palace of Tournelles, its windows crowded with royal and aristocratic spectators, the colours of their costly clothes making a row of bright pictures. On the opposite side of the road, the common people jostled for space, their cheap garments all in shades of faded brown, like a ploughed field in winter. They stood or sat on stools they had brought with them, or perched precariously on window ledges and rooftops. A tournament was a grand spectacle, with the added attraction of possible injury or even death to the high-born competitors. As Pierre entered the palace, he was offered a tray of cakes by Odette, a maid of about 20, voluptuous but plain. She smiled flirtatiously at him, showing crooked teeth. She had a reputation for being easy, but Pierre was not interested in girls of the servant class. He could have got one of those back in Tonnons-les-Joinville. All the same, he was pleased to see her, for it meant that the adorable Véronique was nearby.
"Where is your mistress?" he said.
Odette pouted and said,
"Mademoiselle is upstairs."
Most of the courtiers were on the upper floor, which had windows overlooking the jousting ground. Véronique was sitting at a table with a gaggle of aristocratic girls, drinking fruit cordial. A distant cousin of the Guise brothers, she was among the least important family members, but, nevertheless, noble. She wore a pale green dress made of some mixture of silk and linen, so light it seemed to float around her perfect figure. The thought of having such a high-born woman, naked in his arms, made Pierre feel faint. This was who he wanted to marry, not the bourgeois daughter of a Protestant printer. Véronique had treated him with mild disdain when he first met her, but she had gradually warmed to him. Everyone knew he was only the son of a country priest, but they also knew he was close to the powerful Cardinal Charles, and that gave him a special status. He bowed to her and asked if she was enjoying the tournament.
"Not much," she said.
He gave her his most charming smile. "You don't like watching men ride too fast and knock each other off their horses? How strange." She laughed.
"I prefer dancing."
"So do I. Happily there's a ball tonight."
"I can hardly wait."
"I look forward to seeing you there. I must speak with your uncle, Charles. Excuse me." Walking away, he felt good about that brief encounter. He had made her laugh, and she had treated him almost as an equal. Charles was in a side room with a small boy who had the blonde hair of the Guises. This was his nephew, Henri, aged 8, eldest son of Scarface. Knowing that the boy might one day be the Duke of Guise, Pierre bowed to him and asked if he was having a good time.
"They won't let me joust," Henri said, "but I bet I could. I'm a good rider."
Charles said, "Run along now, Henri. There'll be another bout in a minute, and you don't want to miss it." Henri left, and Charles waved Pierre to a chair. In the year and a half that Pierre had been spying for Charles, their relationship had altered. Charles was grateful for the names and addresses Pierre had brought him. The Cardinal's file on clandestine Paris Protestants was far better than it had been before Pierre came along. Charles could still be scornful and patronizing, but he was like that with everyone, and he seemed to respect Pierre's judgment. They sometimes talked about general political issues, and Charles even listened to Pierre's opinion.
"I made a discovery," Pierre said. "Many of the Protestants use a tailor in the Rue Saint-Martin who keeps a little book with all their names and addresses."
"A gold mine," said Charles. "Dear God, these people are getting brazen.
I was tempted to pick it up and run off down the street with it."
"I don't want you to reveal yourself yet."
"No. But one day I'll get hold of that book."
Pierre reached inside his doublet.
"Meanwhile, I wrote down as many of the names and addresses as I could memorize."
He handed the sheets to Charles. Charles read the list.
"Very useful.
I had to order a coat from the tailor."
Pierre raised the price.
45 livres.
Charles took coins from a purse. He gave Pierre 20 gold écus. Each worth 2.5 livres.
"Should be a nice coat," he said.
Pierre said,
"When will we pounce on these deviants? We have hundreds of Paris Protestants in our records."
"Be patient."
"But every heretic is one less enemy. Why not get rid of them?"
"When we crack down, we want everyone to know it's the Guises who are doing it."
That made sense to Pierre.
"So that the family wins the loyalty of the ultra-Catholics, I suppose,
and people who advocate tolerance, the middle-of-the-roaders, the moyenneurs, will be labelled Protestant." That was subtle, Pierre thought. The Guise family's worst enemies were people who advocated tolerance. They would undermine the entire basis of the family's strength. Such people had to be pushed to one extreme or the other. Charles' political shrewdness impressed him repeatedly. But how will we come to be in charge of stamping out heresy? One day, young Francis will be king. Not yet, we hope. We need him first to establish his independence from Queen Caterina and come completely under the influence of his wife, our niece, Mary Stuart. But when it happens... Charles waved Pierre's sheet of paper. That's when we use this. Pierre was downcast. I hadn't realized your thinking was so long-term. That gives me a problem. Why? I've been engaged to Sylvie Palot for more than a year, and I'm running out of excuses. Marry the bitch, said Charles. Pierre was horrified. I don't want to get stuck with a Protestant wife. Charles shrugged. Why not? There's someone I would like to marry. Oh? Who? It was time to tell Charles what reward he wanted for his work. Véronique de Guise. Charles laughed loudly. You cocky little upstart. You? Marry my relation? It's the arrogance of the devil. Don't be absurd. Pierre felt himself flush from forehead to throat. He had made an error of timing, and in consequence he was humiliated. I didn't think it too ambitious, he protested. She's only a distant relative. She's a second cousin of Mary Stuart, who will probably be Queen of France one day. Who do you think you are? Charles waved a hand in dismissal. Go on, get out of here. Pierre got up and left. Alison MacKay was enjoying life. Since Mary Stuart had become Francis's wife, rather than merely his fiancée, her status had risen, and consequently so had Alison's. They had more servants, more dresses, more money. People bowed and curtsied to Mary deeper and longer. She was now incontestably French royalty. Mary loved it, and so did Alison. And the future held more of the same, for one day Mary would be the Queen of France. Today they were in the grandest room of the Tournelle Palace, in front of the largest window, where Mary's mother-in-law, Queen Caterina, was holding court. Caterina wore a voluminous confection of gold and silver cloth that must have cost a fortune. It was late afternoon, but the weather was hot, and the window was open to welcome a light breeze. The king came in, bringing with him a strong odor of warm sweat. Everyone except Caterina stood up. Henri looked happy. He was the same age as his wife, 40, and in his prime, handsome, strong, and full of energy. He loved jousting, and he was winning today. He had even unseated Scarface, the Duke of Guise, his great general. Just one more, he said to Caterina. It's getting late, she protested, speaking French with a strong Italian accent she had never lost. And you're tired. Why don't you rest now? But it's for you that I fight, he said. This piece of gallantry did not go down well. Caterina looked away, and Mary frowned. Everyone had already seen that Henri was wearing on his lance ribbons of black and white, the colors of Diane de Poitiers. She had seduced Henri within a year of his marriage, and Caterina had spent the last 25 years pretending not to know. Diane was much older. She would be 60 in a few weeks' time, and Henri had other mistresses now, but Diane was the love of his life. Caterina was used to it, but he could still wound her carelessly. Henri left to put his armor back on, and a buzz of conversation arose from the ladies. Caterina beckoned to Alison. The queen was always warm to Alison because she had been a good friend to the sickly Francis. Now Caterina half turned her back on the rest of the group, indicating that their conversation was private, and said in a low voice, "It's been 14 months. Alison knew what she was talking about. That was how long Francis and Mary had been married. "And she's not pregnant," Alison said. "Is something wrong? You would know. She says not. But you don't believe her." "I don't know what to believe,"
I had trouble getting pregnant when I was first married,
Katerina said.
Really?
Alison was astonished. Katerina had borne 10 children for Henri. The Queen nodded.
I was distraught, especially after my husband was seduced by Madame.
This was what everyone called Diane.
I adored him. I still do. But she won his heart away. I believed I might win him back with a baby. He still came to my bed. She ordered him to, I found out later.
Alison winced. This was painful to hear.
But I did not conceive. What did you do? I was 15 years old, and my family were hundreds of miles away. I felt desperate.
She lowered her voice.
I spied on them.
Alison was shocked and embarrassed by this intimate revelation, but Katerina was in the mood to tell the story. Henri's thoughtless, "It's for you that I fight," had put the Queen in an odd frame of mind.
I thought perhaps I was doing something.